Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Now that everyone on the planet is facing the all-consuming threat of the COVID-19 pandemic, we need to seriously face not only the need to innovate our medical and social systems, but also how we make policy. If we can figure out how to quickly limit the virus's spread, that will buffer our communities from severe economic fallout, as well as medical and social catastrophe. Today we talk with Eric Deplace, Sightline Institute's director of the Thin Green Line, about how COVID-19 is showing us in painful relief the urgent need to build stronger people and planet-focused systems that are more resilient to this kind of onslaught. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Well, thanks for having me back, Barbara.
I was just reading an article today about how this pandemic and the shutdown that is caused around the world is really improving air quality. And it's kind of an interesting silver lining, as they say, to this really awful scourge that we're experiencing. I wonder what that makes you think about if we can imagine a post-pandemic world, how can we apply some of the lessons we're learning now about not using our cars and not having so much industry belching pollution into the air in a post-pandemic future?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that I think a lot of folks, at least in my circles, have been asking recently. You know, which is, it's clear the pandemic is a catastrophe and it's a crisis, and really, really bad in lots of ways. And yet, you know, there are some elements of it or a response to it that are positive. And I think it's okay to say that clearly. I think it's okay to say that, you know, the reduction in air pollution, which has its own profound health consequences, is good for us. And maybe it points the way toward a future in which we have less air pollution than we do, or more, you know, less climate pollution than we do, or we have cities that are more oriented around humans than around cars and trucks. And so, you know, I think this is probably a good topic for us to unpack over the next hour. But, you know, I do think that there are features of our response to the pandemic that point the way towards something more positive than what we've had in the past.
Well, actually, there's been some interesting changes in the national conversation, and we're seeing, in some ways, the country pulled apart to real extremes, more so than ever since Trump has been president. And on the one hand is the Trump reaction, which was first to ignore that there even was anything happening, and his concern was more about keeping the stock market up than really being concerned about public health. On the other side is a lot of people who would be mainstream Democrats and even some moderate Republicans who are now making sounds that sound a lot like Bernie Sanders in terms of ways to deal with this crisis. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that, about how, first of all, this crisis is making things that used to be really extreme, like Medicare for All or universal income or extended unemployment benefits or, you know, extending food stamps, how all this is becoming mainstream. And at the same time, we're confronting a backlash from the far right that seems more extreme than ever.
Yeah, you know, I think an emergency like this, a crisis like this, yeah, clarifies something that can become blurry in quote-unquote good times. And what I think it clarifies is that collective action is critical. It's fundamental. We don't have human civilization without collective action and without shared structures. And some of those are cultural structures, and some of those are economic structures, and some are political. And, you know, I don't think that too many people can look at what's happening right now and say, we don't need government intervention. And I think, you know, that is now a widely shared belief that we need stimulus spending, that we need economic supports, that we need rent protection and mortgage protection, you know, and it goes on and on and on. And to me, you know, I think, you know, there's a sort of a fringe right-wing backlash, as there probably is to everything. But, you know, to me, that what really illustrated this clearly was when the Texas oil industry in the Houston Chronicle, I think it was yesterday or today, was saying, look, if we don't figure out how to cooperate, us oil industry players, we're all going to fall apart. And so, you know, even, you know, from, you know, facets of our economy that seem like they're really sort of reflexively right wing or opposed to collective action or sort of rugged individualist free market, they too are realizing, for very different reasons, that we have to collaborate and think collectively, or else the whole system is going to break. And I don't mean the system of capitalism. I mean sort of the whole system of civilization is going to fall apart.
I was just thinking about what Naomi Klein was saying in her most recent book about climate change and the crisis, and how that our system, basically the capitalist system, if I'm not even sure capitalism is the right word for our system at this point, is so geared towards individualism and basically a dog-eat-dog kind of competition, that it's exactly the opposite of what we need in order to come together to really fight this global crisis of climate change. Now it seems like we're at a whole other level of realizing how much we need to come together. So how do you take that, and how do we go with that?
Yeah, it's a great question and a great way to sort of frame up a conversation, but I don't really know the answer. I mean, I think it's clear. I think the events of the last, you know, 3 or 4 weeks have illustrated pretty clearly that the systems we have are too fragmented, and that there are too many misaligned incentives, and we've got, you know, sort of production supply chains that are based on a just-in-time model, and they're scattered throughout the whole world, and that doesn't really work right now. And we have all these national and subnational governments that are accustomed to working together, they're sort of legally obligated to work together, and now all of a sudden it's not clear, you know, there's a risk, and I think we've seen some of this happen already, where they start to compete with one another. And Trump has, of course, made that problem much worse by actively encouraging states to compete with one another for life-saving equipment. But, you know, sort of similar dynamics, you know, potentially playing out in Europe and certainly outside of any kind of framework that's governed by kind of a legal entity like the European Union or the United States. And so, you know, I think that one thing a sort of a crisis of this nature might do is kind of reshape a lot of those structures, because they'll have to respond. They've got to change. And you know, how that happens exactly and what comes out the other side, I think that may be sort of beyond my pay grade.
Well, I'm thinking about all these different causes and visions of the world that a lot of people on the progressive side of the political spectrum have been promoting. And one of them is the importance of localism and buying local, supporting local businesses, having a sense of what your locality is, what your bioregion is, what your ecoregion is. And now I think when we realize, like, for instance, one example is the incredible shortage of medical supplies, whether they're ventilators or they're masks or they're any of the other things that were made in China, that we started to see the supply just drop off drastically while China was on total economic and social lockdown. Has it made you think about how we maybe can talk again about rebuilding local economies, and that we need to really emphasize that as opposed to the globalism that's kind of taken grip of the world in the last 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. And we have lost and so much manufacturing in this country, and that's something that, you know, labor unions, just for example, were screaming about all through the 80s and the 90s, saying, you know, this is not good for the American economy fundamentally. And, you know, unfortunately, I think, you know, Trump was able to tap into some, you know, sort of distorted dimensions of that. But there's a real fundamental truth there that that we should have manufacturing, not just manufacturing jobs, but actually manufacturing, you know, here locally, and not be completely dependent on these scattered global supply chains and scattered global economies. Because, you know, in a crisis like this, it can become, you know, painfully and dangerously clear that we don't want our fortunes controlled by people who don't have our best interests at heart. And I think we can tell a story about that related to personal protective equipment. And I think we can tell a story about it in the fossil fuel industry, in the energy industry, and probably lots of other ways, too. And so I do think that it sets us up now to start thinking a lot more seriously about what needs to be manufactured in North America, and where, and why. Those are conversations that are, you know, decades overdue, in my opinion.
Well, it's also interesting in a kind of terrifying way and conflicting way to watch the economies of our local regions also kind of dissipate. Today, I was reading an article about how Precision Cast Parts, one of our most notorious industries in Oregon and also one of the largest, and I just learned today that they're actually owned by Berkshire Hathaway, which I didn't realize. But they are one of the main pollutants in Portland, and they're actually not that far from my house. They've been very irresponsible over the years in emitting all kinds of effluents and also, I think, poisoning a lot of their workers. Well, today they shut down, and the concern has been how many jobs are being lost because they're laying off most of their workforce. And my first response when I saw that they were shutting down was, well, it's about time because you haven't been taking care of your workers. I'm sure they haven't been working 6 feet apart and you've been just pumping out all this pollution. But there's this real contradiction because on the other hand, I think a lot of worker-oriented organizations and individuals might think, well, it's not good for the workers that Precision Castparts shuts down. At the same time, like Boeing has shut down in Washington and in California, and that's one of the main reasons that Precision Castparts is shut down because Boeing's one of their main customers. Interestingly, Boeing is still operating in Gresham, which I'm not sure is great. So how do we kind of weigh these kinds of conflicts and come out the other side?
What a complex and profound question to ask. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's clear that in the short term, there's already lots of disruption and lots of pain and hardship for workers who are being laid off. And I think that's true from, you know, the daycares and restaurants all the way to the big manufacturers like Boeing. And, you know, my personal belief is that right now it's really hard for us to predict, for anybody to predict how that will evolve and how that will reshape. I think what is clear is that, you know, we as a society, we shouldn't have an interest in people getting laid off of work and not having a path back to work and not having a stable income and not having the ability to take care of themselves. And so, you know, we have to now figure out what sort of public investments are we going to make and how quickly can we make them to provide support for people. And again, I think that's everyone from a childcare worker to a laid off waiter to, you know, somebody at a factory, or an oil driller for that matter, because the economy has been overtaken by events and, it is fundamentally it's in the process of a huge restructuring right now, the results of which are, I think shrouded in mystery. But the choice we have to make is what are we going to do to protect people? When we are able to get our hands sort of back on the gears of restoring the economy, how do we want it to come back? And what should it look like as we try to put it back together again? Those are actually, in some ways, it's expensive, you know, that is $2 trillion stimulus packages that, you know, we'll probably do multiples of. But it's actually kind of a great opportunity in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of promise there that we can recreate something that's better than the model we had, which wasn't really working all that well for workers and definitely wasn't working very well for the environment. There's a part of me that really wants to treat this as a golden opportunity where, you know, the planet has hit the reset button on us, or the virus has hit the reset button on us. And now we have to decide, do we want to go back into the same game we were just playing, or do we want to start a new game?
What do you think of this CARES package that was just passed? How close does it come to your envisioning of what we should be doing and how to support all the people that you mentioned? And I want to add to that artists, the gig economy, freelancers, fellow radio producers. I mean, we're all losing a lot of our income streams. And I think particularly of artists and musicians who can't perform anymore, can't do their shows, can't do theater.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, too. You know, it's true from a local drag queen artist to, you know, somebody who's playing in the NBA. all those folks are suddenly in a very different environment. What do I think about the CARE package? I don't know. I haven't looked at it closely enough to form comprehensive views. I think there are a couple of things that are positive about it. And again, not to say that I have a comprehensive view of it, because I don't. One thing that seems to be positive is the oil industry and the gas industry did not get the bailout that at least parts of that industry wanted, or at least it didn't happen in an obvious or substantial way. And so that's encouraging. I think we'll return to that more a little bit later in the show. The other thing that I think is positive, though, is the one-time sort of income stimulus payment that will be delivered to most Americans, not all, but most. And I think that's important in a practical sense, you know, clearly because people are suddenly very short on income and may not even be able to make rent or meet other sort of basic needs. But it sets up, I think it opens the door to universal basic income. If we can do one stimulus support payment, why not two? And if we can do two, why not 10? And if we can do 10, why not? Why is this not a feature that provides kind of a baseline of economic security and opportunity for all Americans? We can afford it. In fact, I think it's probably cheaper than not doing it. And it's something that you know, maybe we can finally sort of roll this out for the duration of the recession or depression or whatever it's going to be. And then maybe it becomes, you know, like Social Security, like other parts of our safety net, a fixed and fundamentally progressive feature of American society going forward. So that's one thing I like about it. And then there's some other stuff I just don't know about.
Well, we'll get into that in just a second. But you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute. I found it interesting. I got an email from my congressman, Earl Blumenauer, a couple days ago, and he was talking about what should be in the next stimulus package. And it sounded just like Bernie Sanders' platform and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and all the things that they've been saying. And one of them was a minimum of $2,000 a month for people as guaranteed income. I don't know if Earl Blumenauer would have been talking about this 6 months ago or a year ago. So what does that make you think?
It makes me think that change is possible. I mean, Mitt Romney's talking about it too. And there are others, you know, Mitt Romney, of course, is not, you know, on the right flank of the Republican Party, but he's not a Democrat either. You know, so I think it's entirely possible that that this crisis provokes a big shift left and not sort of a gradual incremental, you know, transition that's clawed out of compromised public policy packages, but like, you know, a giant step function that moves us all left. And I think there's a plausible reading of American history that suggests that when faced with crisis, you know, a depression, a war, and so forth, that quite often what's happened on the other side, although, you know, it doesn't necessarily happen in a straight line, but is that we come out of it with a big movement toward a more progressive and just system. It's funny. I mean, we could very well be in a world where sort of Bernie Sanders' platform becomes kind of the median political position for a lot of folks. That doesn't strike me as impossible at all. In fact, it strikes me as in some ways likely because I don't know how you can possibly address a crisis of this magnitude and speed without adopting at least some of those policy prescriptions right away. And so, you know, I take sort of my role in this to be, and I hope others do too, take this as like, okay, well, let's see if what portions of that kind of political or that sort of policy prescription can we accomplish, and what else do we need to be thinking about? How do we really shape our economy in a way that doesn't leave thousands of people sleeping in their cars and under bridges? And how do we, you know, reshape things so that you don't have this massive income disparity that we have, and then also, you know, shift the economy so that it's not wrecking the climate in order to put people to work?
Well, actually, I think that Bernie Sanders would agree with you that he has really shifted the conversation quite a bit to the left. He said that as he was withdrawing from the Democratic presidential race yesterday. But also Joe Biden, I understand, is talking about incorporating much of what Bernie Sanders was saying into his platform. So it does seem like there's a little bit of hope out there.
Yeah, I heard that same news about Biden, which on one level I was surprised by, and on another level, I don't know what other choice he has, actually. You know, it's clear that there's a robust base of support for Bernie Sanders' platform prior to any of this happening. And now that this has all happened, and actually, you know, we don't know the full magnitude of the consequences. It looks like there's a very broad sense of support, at least in principle, for a lot of this stuff. And so, you know, I'm sure Biden did that. You know, maybe he had good intentions, but I'm quite sure that he did poll testing about that. I don't think it was an ill-considered move politically on his part. I think it indicates that he knows where the wind is blowing.
Well, it's interesting because As much as we are all aware of just how moderate and conventional and traditional Joe Biden is, I also remember that when he first became vice president, his chief economic advisor was Jared Bernstein, who is basically a Democratic socialist. And I also remember Joe Biden going to, one of the first things he did as vice president was go to this conference in South America of the progressive governments of the Western Hemisphere. Obama didn't go, but Biden did. So there was part of me that thinks that Biden actually is, he is aware. I'm not sure what he feels in his gut, but he is aware that progressive issues and solutions are a really important part of changing things as they need to be changed. Another thought I was having is the one big difference that we can be thankful for, maybe, in the timing of this pandemic and the timing of the Great Depression, that unfortunately, the Great Depression started within the first year of Herbert Hoover's, his first and only term as president. And this is happening in hopefully the last year of Trump's term. So I wonder how we can push in the election to make some of these visions we have of having a truly human and truly equitable future for all of us and an environmentally safe and just future for all of us through this election process.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big question that's on the table right now. And yeah, I have some sort of broad answers to that, but I think one specific remedy that would help in a big way is a system that we already have deployed very, very well in Oregon and Washington both, and that's voting by mail. It's a super effective, super inexpensive way to get great voter turnout and to keep people healthy and safe during a pandemic. And, you know, I think that this, like the events that are happening right now, and we'll probably talk about Wisconsin in a moment, demonstrate that vote by mail is a system that really makes a lot of sense, particularly for vulnerable populations. And, you know, I'm thinking right now of seniors and others who are health compromised, but seniors in particular, you know, should not be going out in public, standing in lines, going to the polls, coming in contact with a lot of people. There is no need for that to happen. And Oregon and Washington were among the first to demonstrate how well those systems can work. There are lots of others, including red states, that are moving that way quickly. Idaho's one. And so, you know, we have a great opportunity now to roll that out on a national basis. Trump, of course, stands in the way because he stands in the way of everything that's decent, it feels like. But there shouldn't be an impediment to this, and it should have appeal across the political spectrum because fundamentally it keeps people safe. And there are a lot of voters who are going to vote a different way than I will vote, who are going to benefit from this. So it should be something that we can come together around, I would hope. Sightline Institute is spending a whole lot of time right now thinking and talking about vote by mail and trying to figure out what we can do at a state level and at a national level to really move it forward in this era of crisis.
Well, I have a friend who is working with a group, and they were doing calling. This is like, well, the last time I saw her before we all got separated, she was talking about making calls to states where they don't have vote by mail to encourage the voters to trust it, or states that are just starting to try it out. Because I guess there's actually a lot of apprehension on the part of people who aren't familiar with the process. And I know when they instituted vote by mail in Oregon back in 1996, I was not crazy about it because I love the whole ritual of going to the polling place. But I'll tell you, I really appreciate it now, and I've actually really appreciated it for the last 24 years that we've been doing it. So how do we get voters to accept this, as well as getting people who aren't on the progressive side of things to realize the importance of having universal nationwide vote by mail?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is that we need to, it's a leadership opportunity for the Northwest, and it is a great time. And this is what Sightline and others are trying to do, is to tell the stories from Oregon and Washington, that there is no fraud issue, that the system can work inexpensively, that you get better voter turnout, that it protects vulnerable populations, that it helps rural voters and rural seniors in particular, who may have a difficult time, even under the best of circumstances, getting themselves to the polls. And it boosts voter turnout. So in as much as anybody, and Trump is the exception here, thinks that voter turnout is a good thing and wants the electorate to participate in our democracy, You know, I think we have the evidence now in hand to make these arguments and tell these stories. And that's part of the why. So vote by mail is actually, it's growing right now. We haven't seen it sort of full flower. Idaho has already been moving full steam ahead toward it. They're now trying to accelerate that process because of the pandemic. Same story in Utah. I think Arizona is hot on the heels. In the West especially, you know, this is happening. But it's happening in other places too. In Pennsylvania, for example, there was a big bipartisan piece of legislation this last year. It ended up being a little bit controversial, but part of the package, which was largely designed around civic engagement, was an interim step, which is sometimes called no excuse absentee balloting. So rather than having to tell your state or county officials why you should get an absentee ballot, you can just ask for when you get it automatically. And so it's a way of sort of expanding the existing absentee system. You know, they should move right now and just vote by mail for the entire state automatically. But there are some interim steps and they're kind of happening in a lot of places. And Republicans in Pennsylvania supported that package overwhelmingly, as they should, just as Democrats should.
Well, it's interesting because there's some actual footage of Trump saying a couple weeks ago that if we have universal vote by mail, we'll never have Republicans elected again. So when you have that attitude coming from certain Republicans, it sounds like we do have some big obstacles.
It's of course unfortunate that he said that, because it puts a huge obstacle in the way of vote by mail, and by doing so, therefore endangers a whole lot of people who don't need to be endangered. But it's also not accurate. I mean, it is probably true that vote by mail would increase voter turnout among sections of the population that have difficulty voting now. So in some cases, you would get younger voters and more urban, and you know, on average, that's probably a more liberal base voting. But it's, like I said earlier, it's also true for rural voters, and it's also true for older voters, and those tend to be more conservative. So you might get changes in the electorate. There is no chance that vote by mail is going to make Republicans go away. I guess Shops. Just between me and everyone who's listening to this show, I might be even more in favor of it if that were the case. But it's not going to do that. What it will do is simply improve our civic structures and simply provide us a safer and more complete way to participate in our democracy. And we need that stuff if we're going to respond to crises like a pandemic or climate change or economic disruption.
Well, the other thing about vote by mail, which can be a little disconcerting, California's had it for a while, not as long as Oregon and Washington. We have a friend in California, and we were urging him to vote in the primary, and he's a cinematographer, and he had a shoot somewhere, and he was afraid it was going to take all day, and he'd not be able to vote. I said, well, vote by mail, and his problem was he, unfortunately, was registered as an independent, so of course he couldn't vote in the Democratic primary. And in California, if you aren't registered in that primary, you can't vote by mail. You have to vote in person. I think in Oregon and Washington, it's different. In fact, I'm pretty positive it's different. But that was a concern that seems like a loophole that needs to be fixed in California. I'm wondering if that's a problem with some of the other states that now have vote by mail.
It's true in California that there's an issue there that needs to be sorted out. It's also a fairly easy fix. Like it wouldn't take, you know, some huge political lift to change that, and we are probably now in a position where the assembly can change it quickly. I don't know quite enough detail about other states to be able to say conclusively. But I would imagine that there are hiccups and impediments here and there. But this is an opportunity for us to sort them out. And I think now, my hope is that in a bipartisan sense, everyone has the same incentives right now. We want to make the vast majority of Republicans, Trump excepted, want people to be able to vote safely. Vote by mail is the safest way to do it, and we should do it. Hopefully in places where there are hiccups, they can get sorted out. I don't want to move on from this conversation without sort of noting, you know, what happened in Wisconsin, which was just horrible to watch. I don't think that's actually what the future looks like. I think the stories from Wisconsin are too appalling for people to want to continue operating voting in that way during a crisis like this.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace, who's with Sightline Institute. I want to talk a little bit more about what happened in Wisconsin. And maybe for listeners who weren't following it, you can just kind of lay out what the controversy was about and what the results were.
Yeah, and Barbara, you may have to correct me if I get some of the details wrong, but in broad strokes, Wisconsin was holding its primary. The governor had wanted to push the primary back by at least a few weeks so that voters would not have to physically go to polls during a time when they were supposed to be staying at home and not spreading the virus around. His decision was challenged. I think it was challenged by a right-leaning group, or maybe the Republicans themselves. It went to the state Supreme Court, which is a political, those are sort of party-affiliated justices on the Supreme Court, and on party line split, the state Supreme Court ruled that the primary should proceed. And then it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the exact same thing happened, where the Republican-nominated majority ruled on a 5-4 decision that it should proceed anyway. And then what happened is you had lots and lots of people wearing masks, standing in lines and going into crowded public places to cast their vote, endangering poll workers and voters and everybody. And I think in Milwaukee, there were something like 5 open polling spots when normally there are maybe 180. I could be getting the numbers wrong, but it's something
close to that,
just completely out of whack like that. And just, you know, and frankly, a disaster for civic engagement.
Well, the process that really bothered me was that if you are looking at it, I would think in just kind of neutral, bipartisan perspective, you can see that this is an endangering of the public safety. There's no reason to have this primary right now. And the reason why the Republicans, and it was the state legislature who, in fact, overrode the governor. And this is a state legislature, which is a holdover from those horrible Republican Tea Party times when Wisconsin's politics was really pretty gnarly. But they basically were doing everything possible to keep people from voting. And that's, to me, that the big one of the big turning points or turning issues was that people were getting requested absentee ballots, and they weren't able to supply them in time. So people were getting their absentee ballots after they hadn't gotten them by Tuesday when the primary was happening. And the governor and a lot of citizen groups wanted to extend the deadline for people to turn in their absentee ballots. And that's one of the other things the Supreme Court ruled against. So it seemed like it was a really very blatant play at just limiting people's voting. And I think they were probably pretty successful.
Right. So thank you. Thank you for adding the rest of that detail, which I'd forgotten. The absentee ballots. And I think it was Ginsburg who wrote a dissent basically pointing out that if you don't get your absentee ballot until after the election has happened, it's not exactly your fault that you weren't able to vote, and that it's a complete abrogation of democracy in the way that we think about it. That is just a naked attempt at voter suppression.
And a successful one, actually. I think it was
a successful one. Yeah. But I don't know. I guess I'm optimistic that that's not what the future holds. That the experience is too grotesque. I've been wrong about that before. But that it's too grotesque, and that that's not actually a view that can take hold across the country. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe I'm not cynical enough. But I don't think that's. That's not the trends in sort of vote by mail as I read them.
Well, I really appreciate your optimism, but I'm going to throw in another kind of negative curve here. I've been reading a lot about the 1918-1919 flu pandemic, which is becoming a very common topic. And interestingly, I hadn't realized that it was totally forgotten because I found out about it in high school when I read Pale Horse, Pale Rider by Katherine Ann Porter. So it kind of stayed with me somewhere in the back of my mind all this time, and it came back in a big way when this happened. But one of the interesting things about that pandemic, and it was gruesome. I mean, we aren't coming close to what happened there, though I was looking at photographs today of New York hospitals, which have on the outside these white tents and lines of refrigerator trucks, which are temporary morgues. And it looks like the pandemic in 1919, actually, or 1918. And I was thinking about how the memory of that was suppressed shortly after it was over. and it was a conscious suppression. And then we had the Roaring Twenties, and then kind of drove the economy. You know, it did a fever pitch, and then it just crashed in 1929. So it's a really different trajectory than I think you're seeing. And there is a difference, because I don't think that there was a complete depression that came out as a result of that pandemic, though I don't understand why not, because everything was shut down for like almost a year and a half. And I don't expect you to be an expert on that historical topic, which I'm going to try to find somebody who is.
I'm not, so, but I do have a theory about it. But
okay, let me hear your theory.
Well, I mean, the theory is basically that there wasn't a depression that came out of that, because we were still sort of on the heels of World War One, and so, you know, the entire sort of Western economic structure was in ruins by the time the pandemic subsided. So there was this huge period of rebuilding and reinvestment that coincided with the Roaring Twenties, and it lasted for, you know, around 20 years or so before.
Actually, 10 years, I think. Yeah, 10 years.
But that's the theory.
It's interesting, because it was like three of the worst Republican administrations this country ever had, starting with Harding, and then he didn't last very long. There was Coolidge, and then there was Hoover. So it's hard. I don't know what kind of investments were made, and that's something I think I'd like to find out about what was done to really recover the economy. You don't get the sense in the 1920s from the pictures we see of there being all these destitute people living under bridges and living in Hoovervilles and all the things that we know from the Great Depression. So I wonder what happened to those people who weren't part of the big buzz of the Roaring Twenties. Do you have any idea, you know, what it was like to be poor in the 20s?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I'm not well enough educated about that part of American history or world history to know. But I do know that there were, you know, vast regions, including big parts of the Northwest, but certainly Appalachia, where, you know, people did not have, you know, electricity or running water or basic pieces of infrastructure. And a lot of that stuff did not come around until the New Deal. And that, I mean, it was not until that sort of Roosevelt era of actually building big physical pieces of infrastructure that we had rural electrification, and we had a lot of the other stuff that, you know, that we take for granted. And, you know, the pictures of the Roaring Twenties represents, you know, an urban elite that was doing well, but I think not representative of the country at large.
Well, I want to move into one of your favorite subjects, which is fossil fuel. You gave a little teaser about it at the beginning of this hour. So let's talk about some of the dangers that you're seeing from pressures that the fossil fuel industry might be putting on secret corners while we're all busy looking out about the pandemic, and ways that we can maybe change the role that the fossil fuel industry plays in our society.
Yeah, so I have been thinking about this a lot recently, partly because the transition that's happening in the fossil fuel industry is so rapid that I think most people may not be completely aware. I think most people, or many people, have heard that oil prices are down. They're down a lot. But what is happening now, and it was, there was a slide. The oil and gas industry was in a long-term slide, and there were a lot of people, including people in the financial industry, starting to throw up red flags, saying, you know, this doesn't look good, we're pulling back, we're not going to loan anymore. And the coronavirus hit, and the Saudi Arabia-Russia price war hit, and all of a sudden, I mean, get out of town. Like, and I'll give you a couple of examples. The Kansas City Federal Reserve 2 days ago said that 40% of U.S. oil and gas companies will go bankrupt in 2020 if oil prices stay below $30. They're about $25, I think, right now, and most people think they're going to stay south of 30 for this year. 40% of those companies bankrupt, insolvent in 2020. That's staggering. The demand shock from the coronavirus is so severe right now that pipeline operators in Texas and other places are asking producers to stop producing oil because there's no physical place to put all the oil that nobody wants to buy. So we all of a sudden have, and now that may be temporary, maybe short-lived, who knows, but there's an argument that it's not. And that matters because it's not, it's sort of an interesting anecdote. Like, there's physically no more place to store all this oil, but also because when producers stop producing, which is called a shut-in, for economic reasons and also for geological reasons, it can prevent them from producing again very much out of that well, or producing at all sometimes, and so it sets the industry back in a huge, huge way. And I mention these factors because I think what's happening not through intentional public policy choice, but by sort of by accident, is that we are the oil and gas industry, which has been kind of Godzilla for decades, a century maybe, is all of a sudden really weak. And it's we have a golden opportunity now to rebuild a different energy economy on kind of the on the collapsed ruins of this one that hasn't been working very well for us.
So what would that look like?
Well, so to me, and I'll be writing about this a bit more over the coming weeks, it looks like a couple of things. The first prescription is for the companies themselves, the right course of treatment is to do nothing and let the free market economy sort it out in all of the kind of jagged pill that it will be for those companies. Many of them should go bankrupt and go away. And then the second thing is that we need some kind of transition, some kind of just transition or some kind of support for the fossil fuel workers who are being laid off. Some of that's going to be direct income payments probably, but some should be reemploying that workforce in two things, in my opinion. First is remediating the damage of oil and gas and coal extraction. So that's capping abandoned wells. There are hundreds of thousands of abandoned wells in this country that need to be carefully capped and sealed up and treated. There's lots of coal remediation that needs to happen. You can put a lot of people to work that way in the exact areas where you've got unemployed workers. And then some of that workforce should be redeployed to building out the clean energy infrastructure that we need. And that can happen in every corner of this country. And it's the right set of skills again. And then the third thing is that we need a transition not only for workers, but we need a transition for communities that are dependent on fossil fuels. We don't have so many of those in the Northwest. We have some, but there are whole communities. Actually, the state of Alaska is a good example of this, where the pullback of the fossil fuel industry, the pullback of oil and gas, will leave them in financial ruins. And if we don't step in and do something, you know, the consequences of that could be really severe social problems. And so we got to figure out what to do. If you look at Alaska's, you know, state budget, fiscally, the state is a flaming wreckage at this point. And it's because they've largely depended on oil revenues that don't exist now, or they're a fraction of what they were projected to be. You know, what do we do for Alaska? I mean, we want to do something, or it's going to be really rough. And then, how do we make those investments in a way that that change the place?
What impact do you think this is going to have on the proposed frack gas projects in the Northwest, like Jordan Cove LNG or Kalama Methanol or Tacoma LNG?
Yeah, Tacoma LNG is the trickiest one to figure out because it's not a big global export project. The other two, I think, are more straightforward, and I think the smart money would be betting pretty heavily against them at this point. Because of demand reductions, the prices are quite low for LNG, and they're forecasted to stay low for a long time. Methanol prices are also way down. You can use methanol for a bunch of different things, including both plastics manufacturing and vehicle fuel, but you know, how do you make money doing that right now? Good luck. And so my guess is that both of those, which may already die for permitting reasons, they'll die now for economic reasons. Tacoma LNG, as I said, is trickier because you've got a utility in the mix and because it would be replacing a portion of it would be replacing vessel fuel, a portion of it would be doing other things. But I just don't know what the impacts would be.
Well, that one also seems to be a little further along down the road than either Kalama or Jordan Cove. Though it seemed that FERC has been pretty busy and their allies in trying to push through from their side the permit. FERC did give a permit to Jordan Cove and the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline right after the shutdown of the state of Oregon. And and then there's a group, I guess it's actually Northwest Innovation Works, is pushing for FERC to get an extension on the pipeline. It would be going from Williams Pipeline to the Kalama Methanol facility. And that, again, is like happening when people are really having their attention turned to the pandemic and not maybe following these other things as closely. So it feels like there are corners where the fossil fuel industry is just trying to take advantage of people's being distracted by the pandemic.
And on that score, if I sound optimistic on the show, I'm not optimistic about that. The fossil fuel industry, we know that they play dirty. We know that they're very happy to take advantage of any distraction to make mischief. And the Trump administration, of course, has been a willing accomplice. So, you know, can they get FERC to extend the permitting process on the lateral? Probably. I mean, I don't know. But, you know, I'm sure they'll get what they need from the federal permitting agencies. I don't think they'll get what they need from the Department of Ecology in Washington, nor will, I think, Jordan Cove get, you know, any more favorable response from the state of Oregon. And that it does set up, you know, potentially, at least in Oregon, it sets up a clash between the federal and state jurisdictions. But I think all of it, you know, my sense is, will all of it be overridden by the fact that there's you can't make money doing it anymore. And so, you know, investors aren't going to show up for it. I don't think buyers will show up for it. And I think that, and we're seeing this in petrochemicals, we're seeing this in other energy commodities all over the continent, all over the world, really, is, you know, the industry analysts are, you know, they're taking out their black Sharpies and they're drawing a line through all this stuff and saying, nope, not going to happen, not going to happen, not going to happen. Which is a good thing from a climate perspective.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute. Well, for the last few minutes of this show, I just kind of wanted to talk on a kind of a personal level. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of people. I'm talking to you from my home studio. You're at home. Everybody I've talked to for the last few weeks is at home. And we're all dealing with a very new reality. And I just wonder how, as a researcher and a big thinker on issues a lot relating to fossil fuel and supporting communities who are fighting fossil fuel projects, how do you feel like this pandemic is affecting the way that you're working?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'll say this. One of the things that's been a surprising gift to me is I find myself now working on all these issues that we've been talking about, and also playing the role of homeschool teacher for my son, who's 11. And he sits next to me while I work, and I get to sit next to him while he does his schoolwork. And you know, it's hard work. I can't pretend to be an educator, much less a part-time educator. But gosh, it's been really nice to spend that much time with them and to have these mornings together. And you know, it makes me wonder whether there's a lot about our lives that are so busy and so frenetic, and it's not, you know, you've got basketball practice and you've got saxophone practice and you've got this other thing and you've got, but we're gonna move around as fast as we can all the time. Maybe we just all need to calm down. And so there's a part of it, despite all the tragedy, that that feels positive in a way. I'm curious about your experience too, Barbara.
Yeah, well, I'm really torn because as part of me, I mean, I'd only say about half my life has changed because I've been working from home for a really long time. I do have this home studio. I am struggling to get the right equipment so I can do decent phone interviews, and I'm getting there. But other than that, I mean, it's most of my life is the same, except that There's a few big differences, and I was thinking the other day about what I miss the most, and the first one is just going to the grocery store and it not being a terrifying experience. And like, I miss Powell's books, I miss going into KBOO, I miss the library, I miss my friends. I'm getting to know my neighbors a lot better, which is really wonderful. And so it's a mixed bag, but then I look at photographs of other places around the world, and today, particularly New York, and my heart breaks. But looking at what's happening, I think I am so lucky. My life is not being affected on a really core level yet. And yet, when I saw those pictures of those refrigerator trucks outside of Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, it just tore me apart. So I'm aware, you know, we're living through this pandemic, and it brings me back. As I just finished rereading Pale Horse, Pale Rider last night, and it just kind of really brought me back to the images that I had back when I was young reading that book that seemed so far away from anything I'd ever experienced, and here we are experiencing it. So yeah. What do we do?
Yeah, I think your observation is a helpful supplement to what I said, which is, like, I feel extremely fortunate. You know, I still have a job, and I'm safe and healthy. You know, for me, the first impact of all this, when it really hit, was there's a little grocery store about a 5-minute walk from here where my son and I go all the time. And the owner of that market was among the first people to die from coronavirus in Seattle. It felt like a gut punch, you know, I think it felt like a gut punch to the whole neighborhood. He was just a wonderful, wonderful human. And it felt really real. And, you know, and there's flowers outside the grocery store right now. I don't want to make light of any of this, much less in developing countries where, the impacts are much harder. But, you know, at the same time, the path we've been on from a climate perspective leads us to much, much worse outcomes than this. And so I guess there's a part of me that hopes that, you know, out of the tragedy and despair, that I think it's really reasonable to fear that we can sort of take up the notion that collective action can solve big problems for us. And maybe we move in a different direction from that. That's as close to wisdom as I think as I've achieved from this lockdown so far.
Well, I have a friend actually who said that either he read this or he thought it of himself, that this is just practice for the coming climate crisis. And I think rather than thinking about practice like it's going to be that much worse and we're really going to suffer, thinking about what you just suggested about understanding and really implementing the whole reality of collective action and what that means. So any thoughts about how we can reinforce that?
You know, that's not my core competency, to be honest with you. But last night I had a great conversation with some of the leaders from the Lummi Nation who invited me to participate in a conversation. And I was reminded during that conversation that there's a fair bit I know about voting policy and a fair bit I know about the fossil fuel economy. And where real wisdom is and where real leadership is on collective action and community and care is with Indigenous communities, and it's with Native leaders like that. And so I have to say, I spent an hour and a half last night in this conversation, and I felt a million times better by the time we were done. My resolution as of last night is to spend more time paying attention to those particular people, but to those communities in general, because I think that's the best guidepost that we have right now.
Well, actually, one of the gifts to me for doing all this work around the fossil fuel projects in the Northwest is I've gotten to hang out a lot with a number of Indigenous people and interview them and really learn from them and really understand their vision. And I think it's almost a kind of a no-brainer that Indigenous people understand the way the world works, the natural world works, in ways that we who grew up and been raised for centuries so disconnected to it don't understand. So I do appreciate what you're saying and thinking about ways that we can connect. And through all this time of social distancing, do you have any idea how we can reach out more and make those connections?
I'm taking a big, deep breath. I don't know how, but I maybe your listeners will have some ideas and they can send them to us, or maybe you have some thoughts. I don't know exactly what to do, to be honest with you.
Thinking out loud right now, but I guess that what I've been feeling for the last few weeks is all this isolation. I mean, I'm connected to the people that are in my circle, both politically and socially and whatever. But I don't have that many, they don't have the same kind of connection and long-term connection with Indigenous communities. So it's like figuring out how to do that over the distance is interesting. But if anybody's listening and they have any ideas, you can send them to me at KBOO, and we will definitely talk about that in the future. Actually, I got an email or a letter a few weeks ago from somebody who was complaining that I say this show is about our place on the planet. And he said, you never really talk about that. So maybe that's something I should have a conversation with an Indigenous person soon, is to really understand what our place on the planet is and how this pandemic is really showing us about that.
I would love to listen to that show. I hope you decide to do that.
I'll have to figure out how, but I'll work on it. Well, anyway, Eric, it is really good to talk to you. I really appreciate you, what you're doing. And it's also interesting to talk to you from the first epicenter of the pandemic, which I think that your community has gone through a whole lot more than we're going through in Oregon. So I appreciate that, too.
Well, thanks, Barbara. I always appreciate the chance to talk with you, whether it's on the radio or in person. But thanks again for inviting me on.
Sure. Well, thanks. And we'll talk again soon. Today we've been talking with Eric DePlace, Sightline Institute's Director of the Thin Green Line, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our other KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all its volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. Next week, we'll talk with Dennis Hayes, who made the first Earth Day happen 50 years ago. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go with some music by John Prine, who died a few days ago from COVID-19, and it's a big loss to all of us. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Avery Hill, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Then the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken, then they rode it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. When I die, let my ashes float down the Green River. Let my soul roll on up to the Rochester Dam. I'll be halfway to heaven with paradise waiting, just 5 miles away from wherever I am. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.